The following presentation is a Vintage Quixotic production.
Jungle Natives, the all-new, unofficial Guns N' Roses podcast.
Yeah, she said she's going to wreck my car. I know what to do.
Here's your hosts, Brooke Ellis and Christina Rice.
Hey, this is Brooke Ellis with the lovely Christina Rice once again. Welcome to the second part of our inaugural episode of Jungle Natives, and let's get right to it. Okay, so Appetite comes out. Gina has just come back from England, where they did a few shows at the Marquee. I think they did three or four shows. The first one was sort of rough, but by the end of their residency or whatever, they had really won over the audience. They get their first European cover story with Kerrang. Which wasn't too big of a deal, because I think Kerrang was weekly.
Was it really?
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, or bi-weekly. But it was definitely a magazine you could pick up, you know, a different issue of often. And you mentioned you had the Music Connection from 86.
Yes.
That's actually their first cover story.
That is, isn't it?
Yeah. How did you acquire that?
I wrote to Music Connection and asked if they had back issues, and they sent me one.
Oh, nice.
I think I wrote to them probably like in 1988.
Cool. Yeah, you know, I was a Guns N' Roses collector for years, and that was one of the pieces that I needed to get. And when Steven Adler had moved to Vegas and I was out there visiting him, there was a copy of the Music Connection, you know, on the table. I was like, oh, man, I've been looking for that. He picks it up, signs it, and gives it to me. And that's the kind of guy he was. He was really cool like that. So I'm happy to say that I have a signed copy of Music Connection.
Signed, I had Duff sign mine when I met him at Pirate Radio, but he dated it 91. That kind of sucks.
But that doesn't suck when you put it this way. When you look online, like on eBay and stuff, now the autographs are dated, you know, 2005. So 91, you're still right in there in the heyday. I've got a signed copy of Appetite. It's from a reputable dealer, and there's no mistaking these are the authentic signatures. You know, Steven authenticated his for me. He's like, yeah, I signed that. But Duff signed it 92. And I'm thinking, oh, man, you know, why did he do that? Because he got Steven's signature. Steven was already out of the band. I think maybe he might have signed it 91, actually, because I got it in, like, 93. Yeah, so Duff would always date his signatures, and Slash would, too, I think.
I have to, because I actually had Slash sign my copy of Rolling Stone that he's on the cover, and I have to look and see. I don't remember if he dated it or not.
Right. So GNR comes back from England. They just did some successful shows at the Marquee. Appetite comes out, and then they're out on tour again, and they got a pretty grueling touring schedule.
And they played, I think they played Perkins Palace in November of 87.
Actually, it was in December.
Was it December?
Because,
did you go?
I didn't go.
Me neither. Again, I was too young to be able to go to concerts.
Right, but those shows
still bitter.
Are pretty spectacular. At least there's one of them that's on a bootleg that's very, very
yes.
well circulated. Now, you know what makes these shows sort of unusual? Is that Fred Corey of Cinderella is playing drums. Steven had gotten drunk, and he punched a lamppost, he broke his hand, and he was very upset that GNR did those shows. Because you have to understand that they did this tour, they shot the Jungle video, I think very early on, like August 1st, before they go out on tour with the Cult. Then they do a bit of a tour of Germany, where they had that fiasco with one of the members of Faster Pussycat. Duff totally kicked the shit out of one of the guys of Faster Pussycat. I think he like taped him up with duct tape and put him in an elevator and had Steve help him. And Steve had no idea why Duff was doing it. But I remember talking to Brent Muscat of Faster Pussycat years later. And he's like, yeah, you know, that was the only thing they talked about in the press was Guns N' Roses kicking the shit out of this dude in Faster Pussycat. But anyway, they're on this grueling tour schedule. They're out with the Cult in Canada. So it's sort of a homecoming for them now that the album's out to be playing Perkins Palace. And Steven said, do you think they would have done it if Slash broke his hand? You know, so he was really upset that they got somebody to replace him for those shows.
No, I think I have that bootleg. A lot of this is coming back to me now. I think I do have that bootleg somewhere.
Well, one of the things I really like about that bootleg is Axl's really emotional in his rants. Gosh, I used to be able to recite these things. That's how crazy I was. And for a future episode, I would actually like to get a psychologist and to explain why people attach themselves to certain things, like whether it's movies or music. Obviously, for young people, it's all about identity. Your identity is pretty much what music you listen to. But when you take it that extra step further, you know, for me, listening to these bootlegs over and over again, and Axel, you know, talking about Todd Crew, you know, he says, see, I've never been able to verify this, but Axel says he OD'd and ended up at Cedar Sinai, you know, and when he got out, Todd Crew hugged him and said, "You can't do this to the family," you know, and then Todd went ahead and OD'd shortly thereafter. But the emotion in Axel's voice sounds pretty darn sincere. And in his rant before Out to Get Me.
Oh, yeah. I think his voice cracks. Like, he's actually crying.
Yeah. And
I think he really is.
A guy in the audience, when Axel tells a story, you hear him go, "That sucks!" You know, because, and it does suck. You know, his buddy died. And then his rant before Out to Get Me, he's like, "They could all just get in the boat and float straight to hell as far as I'm concerned." But it sounded so real and so angry. And Steven Adler used to hate when Axel would go on these long rants, and I told him, "Dude, no, you don't get it. This is, for me, what separates one bootleg from another. If it has a good Axel rant on it, it's worth it to me." When I first got Chicago 92 on VHS back in, like, 95, Axel's rant in that had me standing up going, "Yes, yes!" But then again, you know, I'm a bit of a crazy person, but I had to explain to Steven, like, no, those rants are actually kind of cool, and that's sort of what separates the band. You know, Axel's got that deep voice, which is very contradictory to his singing voice. You wouldn't expect that to come out of him. But, yeah, those Perkins Palace shows were really cool, and Fred Corey's on drums, but they did bring Steven out to say hello to the audience. I guess it's just 2 months later, in February of 88, that Appetite Goes Gold, and shortly thereafter they do The Late Show. How great of a performance
is that? Was that Arsenio Hall?
No, some black dude.
I've never seen that.
You've never seen a performance?
I've never, ever seen. And it's not on YouTube, is it?
Sure it is.
I have never been able to find it. You have to send me a link. I did not see it.
Oh, that's crazy.
I've never seen it.
That is crazy.
I've never seen that.
What an amazing performance. And it's funny because
did they play You're Crazy?
An awesome version of You're Crazy. And Slash is on fire. And I don't want to get too far ahead because we're going off on a tangent, okay. But you know, the first time I heard Used to Love Her, I bought Gene Arliss. I was at home, and I put the CD on. And when it got to I Had to Kill Her, I just started busting up laughing. It was the first time I heard it. It was fresh, and I was like, oh, my God, these guys are awesome. Well, the black dude that hosted that show totally blew the whole joke. I mean, I didn't see it when it was live. I saw it much later. But, you know, he's like, "Coming up, Guns N' Roses with I Used to Love Her, but I Had to Kill Her." So he kind of ruined the punchline, I would imagine, for some people. But it's an awesome performance. I mean, that's Guns N' Roses in their prime. And it's an acoustic performance, although Steve is actually playing a live kit. You know, Izzy and Duff and are seated, and Slash is standing, and Slash is on fire. And it's a great bit of GNR history.
I've been waiting well over 25 years to see.
And then the following month, in April, they shoot Sweet Child of Mine. And I think this is the video that really put them over the top and really defined them as a band. I mean, image-wise, it doesn't get any cooler. The best move that Axel ever made was putting on that bandana. I mean, you know, he looks pretty damn cool. They all look cool. Duff, the skinny dude with the CBGB shirt. You know, you got Steven with the TSOL shirt, you know, the punk band TSOL. These guys just have cred dripping out of their ears, you know, Slash with the hair.
And the hat.
Yeah. How iconic is that? And kudos to him for, you know, not changing his image, you know, not going whichever way the wind blows or following any trends. Nobody has stayed true to himself as much as he has. But Sweet Child of Mine, you know, it's a low budget. I won't say it's low budget. I don't know. But, I mean, it's, you know, there's nothing special. It's not November Rain, but I think I would almost rather watch that than November Rain.
I think I would want to watch most Guns N' Roses videos instead of November Rain.
Although that's pretty epic. I could do a whole episode on that.
Except for Slash's guitar solo in November Rain, which is one of the coolest things ever committed to film.
And by the way, you would probably know from watching the making of November Rain that church that he comes out of, obviously the scale of it is much smaller.
Right.
But it was a prop left over from Heaven's Gate. One of the biggest box office bombs of all time. It came out like 1980, but that's what they use, you know, in Slash's in the Prairie Field. And I don't mean to go off on a tangent again, but on the flip side, the worst thing ever is Slash coming out of the water and estranged in what is obviously, you know, a tank with a painted backdrop.
I don't think Slash would dispute that
yeah.
that statement one bit.
But talking about going over the top, and I don't want to go off on a tangent, but here's Slash's idea is like, well, you know, now I'm a huge rock star, so I'm completely removed from this Hollywood scene. So I'm floating, you know, amongst these people, you know, on Sunset. But he's clearly not floating. He's clearly on wires, and people are like trying to like not trip on the tracks that are laid out for him because he's also on a track. And Andy Moynihan, shame on you with I think Andy worked on that one. Poor editing or whatever. You didn't get good. You know what sucks? I could have been in that video.
Really?
We have mutual friends I will probably talk about in the future because they have some awesome stories. They told me about when the estranged video was shooting, and I'll have to get into that in a future episode because that gets into a whole thing where I'm hanging out with Chris Farley, and it was just, you know.
I got kicked off the set of that video trying to meet Axl.
Oh, tell me about it.
So, a couple of friends of mine knew where it was being shot.
The same friends. Because they told me about, you know, going to the place where Axl was shooting the scene where he's in the shower and he's laying down.
Where he gets up, his soul rises from his body. It was that. It was the middle of the night. I think it was like 1 a.m. that they were shooting this thing. And again, I don't know where the hell it was. You know, so they my friends drive me there and they're like, well, we can't go. So you can go. And I'm very timid, like play by the, I don't know if I'm timid, but I'm a very play by the rules. Like I'm a very straight and narrow play by the rules person. They're like, well, you know what? You just have to bullshit your way onto the set. Like, you just have to lie your way on. And I'm like, okay, but it's Axl, and I've never, you know, I mean, I was the Slash girl, but I still wanted to meet Axl. And so I, like, marched past the parking guard, and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to see the video, and he didn't care. And so so I sneak onto the set, and there's Axl, and he's laying in front of the green screen, you know, for that shot. And
wow.
Yeah, and I'm sitting, yeah, and I'm dying a little inside, I really am, and I'm sitting there, and finally this woman comes up to me, or she was on the younger side, and she goes, can I help you? And I go, oh, yeah, you know, I'm studying film in college. By this time, I was in college, and I was studying film. And I had the name of some secretary with the BFD, the production company. So I threw out, I'm like, oh, so-and-so said, you know, for like a class, you know, as part of like a class assignment, I could come observe the filming so I could get extra credit. And, you know, it's like the only time in my life I've just bold-faced lied. And she goes, oh, really? I go, yeah, yeah. And she goes, well, this is actually, you know, a closed set. And I go, oh, okay. In the meantime, Earl, Axel's bodyguard, who's like that 7 foot tall black guy, scary as all hell, he walks up and I'm starting to shake a little. So she's like, yeah, this is a closed set. And I'm like, first she asks, who am I? I'm like, oh, I'm a film student. I look at her and I go, and you are? And she goes, I'm the director of the video.
But she wasn't, I don't think.
I have no
Maybe
idea.
She was a director of the
Maybe
green
Maybe she
screen.
Was an assistant director. Yeah, I don't know. And I'm like, oh. And so she's like, it's a closed set. And I go, okay. And they both just stare at me. And I said, oh, does that mean I need to leave? Yeah, you do.
Sounds like you handled yourself pretty well, though, and pretty convincingly.
I think I pulled it off for, you know, about 3 minutes. And, and once they said I had to leave, I was not going to, you know, I was not going to bum rush Axl. So I walked away. I walked away with my dignity intact somewhat.
Yeah, and that's another thing I want to mention. You know, we were friends because of Guns N' Roses, but I know a couple times you were over my house and I was smoking pot, and you said how you were straight-laced, and you were very straight-laced. I think that was like sort of a turnoff for you, like, oh, man, you know. And I was always like the stoner, and, you know, obviously I partied with Steven Adler and got into some trouble with that type of thing.
Yeah. And I became a librarian. So,
and, yeah. And you literally are a librarian.
I am a librarian.
And we're both published authors. Yeah. Who would have guessed? And, you know, so you almost got to meet Axl. Did Axl look over at you or anything?
Oh, no, no. Yeah, because it was dark. It was really dark. So it was, yeah, he was completely oblivious. And I do have one more Slash story.
Well, we don't want to blow all of our stories. Okay. Because I do want to do an episode, Meeting Your Heroes. You know,
okay.
Because,
oh, because, yeah. Then
yeah.
I got a good one for
and
you.
And you have others, too, because I know you've told me others. But
no, did not meet Axl. I just saw him from about 10 feet away.
And one thing that comforts me, you know, looking at all these GNR forums like MyGNR and Here Today Gone to Hell, there's a lot of men with man crushes with Axl. And I was totally one of them. And he's the only guy that I did not get to meet. So that's always a bit of a disappointment for me. I came close a couple times, and I'll get into those stories because they actually are kind of funny in themselves. Yeah, we're going off on a tangent, but that's okay because it's all about Guns N' Roses. That's what the people listening to love, and that's why they're listening. And I think that we've had enough experiences as fans that it warranted telling our stories.
Absolutely. Like, they drove my teenage years. And, you know, my teenage years were miserable. I think everybody's teenage years were miserable. But, you know, I had my own stuff and family situations going on. And they were my anchor. They were what I clung to. And those 4 years in between Appetite and The Illusions were, like, four of the longest years of my life. And that was, like, between, you know, eighth grade and senior year. And that was always my, you know, I have to, as much as I might hate life right now, Guns N' Roses is going to have a second album, and I really want to be around to hear it.
Right.
And, like, then that, you know, it may sound hokey or, you know, overblown now, but at the time, that was really sincere. Like, that was what got me out of bed the next day, was that they were probably going to have a second album.
And me too. And, you know, you talk about the four-year span between Appetite and Illusions. It was an eternity then.
Oh, my God. It was so long.
You know, now, 4 years, like, if Coldplay, you know, put out an album 4 years ago, that's yesterday to me. Not that I'm a Coldplay fan, but now bands, you know, will go years without putting out an album, and it's sort of the norm. And but back then, like, dang, when the heck is Guns N' Roses coming out with an album? And there was always false starts because I was actually working in a record store, and that was probably, you know, the question I got asked most often. Hey, when's the new Guns N' Roses coming out? Oh, it should be out in June 90, you know, and it just kept getting pushed back so far to the point that Geffen said, look, you guys hit the road, go on tour, or I don't know if Geffen said that, but they ended up touring Illusions
months before it came out.
And these are the types of stories that I think that the fans, especially the younger ones, would be interested in because, you know, imagine going to see Guns N' Roses and hearing new songs for the first time because their albums are months away from being released. So you're hearing Back Off Bitch, November Rain, Right Next Door to Hell, you know.
Estranged. I mean, hearing, like, you know, Axl would talk about Estranged. We knew Estranged was coming. And then you finally hear it for the first time, and it's live.
I don't remember him talking about Estranged. Oh, I remember him talking about November Rain, where he said he would quit the music business if it didn't come out right. And he went to get Jeff Lynne to produce. I remember that was the epic he was talking about for years. November Rain, November Rain.
No, we knew about Estranged. We knew about it.
Nice. You know, and this is where you get into something that is really important, but you kind of just have to take it with a grain of salt. Estranged wouldn't be what it is without what Slash contributed to it. Just like Sweet Child of Mine. Anyway, I don't want to get into that too much, but there's no underestimating the profound contribution of those original members, you know, and I think it's very sad that you know, I think it's their right and it's their legacy that they should be a part of it, and they're not. And I think that's wrong, but, you know, then again, I'm just a, you know, who am I? I'm a big dork, so.
And yet we still have, I think, a little bit of credibility because we saw the original lineup live.
Exactly.
At least I have that, if nothing else. I saw the original five guys twice.
I actually did not see the original five guys.
No,
and it's funny because I'm sorry. I mean, I told you about my friend True Mason.
Yeah.
The first time I saw them live was over at his house. Oh, by the way, I didn't mention this to our listeners, but Christina and I are 20 minutes, or had at the time lived 20 miles from LA. I mean, we're right there. So it's not like, you know, we had to take a big hike to go to Hollywood or anything.
No.
And my friend True Mason lived in Van Nuys, and that's where I saw the Ritz show for the first time when it was on MTV. Mm-hmm. And how cool are they in that? Now, you know, they talk about, you know, I've read in forums, why don't they release that as a live album? Well, I'll tell you what. Like, you listen to Sweet Child of Mine, which wasn't even a single yet, so it doesn't get the big. But Slash is pretty off on that. On Sweet Child, and
Izzy, it's been so... I mean, I remember vividly the first time I was at my dad's house in Yorba Linda, and I so vividly remember seeing that for the first time.
Oh, well, it's so dynamic, so charismatic. There's so much energy. If I'm not mistaken, that same night, Great White played. Do you know?
That doesn't sound beyond possible, but I can't say for sure.
I'm probably wrong, but for some reason...
That's a detail I would have just pushed out of my mind.
Yeah, of course.
It's not Guns N' Roses.
But for some reason, I'm thinking it was actually Great White's show.
It might have been.
But I could be... I'm probably wrong, and the hardcore fans are like, oh, this guy doesn't know anything. But... yeah, I mean, what an awesome show. We could do a whole show on the Ritz performance, because that thing aired, and this is another thing like that Steven Adler didn't know, like how often like the Ritz show was played on MTV.
Well, and then they ended up cutting up, they would show Heaven's Door and play it as a video.
Well, yeah, I think MTV did that maybe in conjunction with Geffen, because that's when they did that to coincide with the release of the single. And I remember being a little disappointed at the... Days of Thunder studio version. I didn't like that Axl doubled his part on the verses.
I remember being very disappointed in
really?
That. Really? I even the version on The Illusions, I don't particularly care for.
Well, it's
for.
The same thing, except...
Yeah. No, so, I think that song comes over so much better live.
Right. It's the same, except they cut out the parts where Axl's like, it wasn't their fault. But Izzy's not on that track, and it sounds like it's played to a metronome. In fact, Slash's first solo, you know, is very stiff. You know, he's not giving it any vibrato. I remember thinking that. I remember not liking Axl's doubled vocals on the verse, you know, with the high part in the background. That wasn't necessary. But I love it now, because that intro, Slash's guitar tone on that first G chord, it just gets me every time. And I love all the live versions of Knocking on Heaven's Door. And just a three-chord song, you know, it's like the antithesis of what they're doing on Appetite, because people don't really give them credit for actually... The complex song structures that they've got going on.
Absolutely. When I was, I took guitar lessons when I was a teenager, and my guitar teacher, I would just bring in songs I wanted to learn. You know, and this is like an accomplished musician, and so I'd bring in Guns N' Roses. I remember one time I brought in a Guns N' Roses song, and he's listened to it, and he just smiles and shakes his head and says, "Man, that's the thing about Guns N' Roses. You never know what direction their song's going to go."
Wow.
And I just took that as such a badge of pride that this guy who was a musician, he'd been playing forever, could acknowledge how awesome they were.
Right. Well, like the intro to My Michelle, and when it kicks in, obviously. I mean, talk about a riff conveying darkness and seediness. I had never heard anything like that. You know, and I had been playing guitar maybe 3 years at that point. And then when it kicks in, it's just so dynamic. And so many other bands have tried to copy that, like Skid Row. And, you know, I've tried to copy the Guns N' Roses groove.
Nobody ever could.
No.
For as big as they were, there was never, I don't think there was ever anyone you could say was a blatant imitator, because I don't think anybody came close.
Right. I mean, Skid Row was kind of, especially with Monkey Business, where they're copying the Paradise City riff. But here's the thing. The bands that came after, like Asphalt Ballet and Kick Tracy, what they didn't realize was that Guns N' Roses wasn't about precision. Yeah, they had the groove, but it was pretty sloppy. I don't maybe that's an inaccurate thing to say, but it was definitely loose. And then when these other bands were, you know, that came out thereafter, and they're sort of imitating the sound, definitely bands were imitating the groove. It was like Precision City, you know, it was like super tight, and it just sounded too polished, you know, and Guns N' Roses was anything but polished. You know, the end of Rocket Queen, I think that's Axl's finest recorded moment.
It is. And anytime I would listen to that song ends and it just make me want to listen to the entire album over again.
Wow.
You know, and I have to say, like, when I, you know, so, you know, after I really got into them, I my mom was driving me to Orange County to my dad's house. And so I put it on because I thought, oh, I'm just going to screw with my mom. I'm going to put on It's So Easy and watch my mom cringe. But she's not, you know, my mother's not that much of a Puritan. But I thought, oh, she's going to hate this and ha ha ha, you know, trying to be as rebellious as I can at age 13. And she's listening to it and she's not saying a word. And I think,
For It's So Easy?
The whole album.
Oh, okay.
We're listening because it's a long drive, and we're listening to the whole album, and she's not screaming at me to turn it off like she had with some of the other, like Motley Crue. Oh, my God. Like, and we listen to it, and I'm just looking at her going, well, what? And she goes, they're really good.
Wow.
She goes, these guys, and this is, you know, this is before they broke big. And my mom said, you know, if they can stay off the drugs and, you know, these guys could really be big.
Right, because they already had a reputation.
Yeah, and my mom's, you know, my mom's a musician.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, as much as I wanted to defy her at that age, I still valued her opinion when it came to music. And so, yeah, for her to say, for her to actually like a band I liked was, that was a first.
That sounds special. Yeah, and for her to say, stay off the drugs, because early on they had this reputation. I mean,
and it's the lyrics, which, you know, I was so young, I was naive to all of that, but my mother's listening to it, and she knows damn well what they're singing about.
Right, and what's cool is they're not posers, and to prove this point, you look at some of these early interviews, like I just reread that BAM magazine interview, and one thing they say is, no, we stay away from drugs. That's one thing that we don't partake in. You know, and you hear this in different forms, in different interviews, and that's exactly what a junkie says, you know, and because they're for real. You know, the guys that want to come off as cool and smoking, they're not going to say, oh, no, we don't do drugs, because that's not cool, you know, unless you're a striper. You know, of course, they ended up getting, you know, caught in their own little web of deception, you know, because they did do a little partying, from what I understand. And in fact, GNR and Stryper were supposed to play a show together. I remember an interview with Duff where he said that they were supposed to do something with Stryper, but it never happened.
I can't even imagine.
Right.
But I am slightly intrigued. You know, and I have, you know, but yeah, and their, you know, their the subject matter of their songs was so, as we talked about earlier, was so very rooted in that Hollywood scene, which for me as a 13, 14-year-old, I could not relate to at all. So I couldn't listen. I couldn't listen to their lyrics and draw from it. So it was so much driven by the music for me. Like it really was. And I would desperately try to my Michelle, like, honey, keep on trying and you'll get what you deserve. Yeah, that's my lyric. But overall, you know, I couldn't relate to their experiences, and yet the music just grabbed me in such a way. You know, one of my best friends in high school listened to alternative music, and you know, I don't think it's really apparent now, but like in the 80s and 90s, like there were these very definitive musical genres that you didn't cross. And so my friend, you know, she loved The Cure and The Smiths, and there was no reason why we should have been friends other than I think we appreciated the passion for the music that we did listen to. Like, people would stop us at the mall because I would have a Metallica shirt and she would have a Cure shirt. How could you be friends? Like, that's how divided it was. And for my 16th, she loved The Smiths, which, and I just hated The Smiths, and I still am not a Smiths fan. But for my 16th birthday, she typed out, this is before computers, on her typewriter, she typed out the lyrics of a bunch of Smith songs and gave them to me. And these lyrics were so relevant to my existence. And it just, like, pissed me off beyond belief that, you know, Morrissey had the soul of a 16-year-old girl. And yet, it still didn't, he couldn't draw me in the way Guns N' Roses music did. So I think for me, it was so much about the music more than the existence and the lifestyle.
Interesting, because I'm actually a Smiths fan, but there are songs and lyrics that are a little, for lack of a better term, a little too gay for me. You know, a little too prissy, but I appreciate what's going on there.
But perfect for a 16-year-old girl.
Exactly. Now, on the other hand, I'm actually living that life that you could not relate to.
Right.
When Appetite is out. My life is centered around partying. It's centered, I had already freebased cocaine for the first time in 1987. Yeah, I'd obviously done coke, lines, and stuff before that. You know, drinking all the time. Weed was just, that was from maybe 14 on, you know, smoking pot like almost every day. That was my life. I mean, my life is completely different now. You know, I mean, if I smoke weed now, it's just like I just want to go to sleep. If I go to a concert and somebody hands me a joint, I better not, because I'm going to want to sit down and, you know, because I'm old. You know, I'm older and things change. But I was living the life, and I had up until I was in my mid-30s. So I totally related to the lyrics and the seediness, although I did live in a middle-class environment. You know, so it wasn't like I was struggling. You know, sure, I'd go to Hollywood, especially like around 93, and I had the beard and the long hair, you know, and the cut-off flannel. I think that I had the talent and the music to back it up, but I definitely wasn't Axl Rose, even though I wanted to be. And you could probably vouch for the fact that I desperately wanted to be Axl Rose.
You desperately wanted to be Axl Rose. I, in a manner of speaking, like, I desperately wanted to be Slash in some way. Like, I didn't want to do heroin. But
see, I did.
I know, like, I didn't. But, man, I tried to look like Slash. You know, right. And I had a friend, and I didn't, like, when I was younger, like, I didn't date a whole lot. And I remember one of my friends saying, well, why would any guy want to date you? It'd be like dating Slash. And I thought, well, what's wrong with that? He's awesome.
That's funny. Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, when you and I met, I knew right off the bat that you were a, you know, for lack of a better term, you know, clean-cut, nice young girl.
Despite my flannel over my Ralph's uniform.
Right. But I knew this wasn't somebody to mess with, you know what I mean? Like, but we, nobody else loved Guns N' Roses. In fact, working at that Tower Records, I worked, you know, when the Illusions came out, they did a midnight show. They stayed
I
open.
Was there.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. You would think, you know, Guns N' Roses is huge. I'd have all these, you know, friends that were into Guns N' Roses. Well, I had just moved from New Jersey to California, so I didn't know anybody. I didn't go to school here, so it was pretty rough for me. And the employees at Tower were so pretentious that on their badges, they made little labels on the day of Use Your Illusions that said, fuck Guns N' Roses.
Those bastards.
Yeah, and you have to understand that this is right around the time. No, wait a minute. I think at the very least, Gish by Smashing Pumpkins may have been out by then. And I think Temple of the Dog, but I could be wrong. But definitely.
No, I think Temple of the Dog might have been out.
In 91?
I think so.
Well, there's so. Definitely a scene like with Sonic Youth that was, you know, the super ultra hip people were already not liking.
They'd moved on.
They had already moved on.
Yeah, and I remember when I was in college, this is probably around 93 or so, and I was I started off as a journalism major, and I'm in a journalism class, and we had to interview the person next to us. And so, the person interviews me, and I'm still, you know, like, I know Guns N' Roses have had their rough spots by this time, and, you know, those videos have come out, but I'm still wearing, you know, I'm still proud, like, come on. And so we had to, like, go in front of the class and say, okay, this is what I learned about this person. And when my person said that, and she loves Guns N' Roses, people started snickering.
Oh, jeez.
I thought, how dare you? How dare you?
Well, just like, you know, and this is something that nobody remembers, but by 93, Guns N' Roses were the overblown, bloated rock act that kind of wasn't cool to like, maybe for a few stragglers that were in middle school or something, but Nirvana had taken over, you know, Red Hot Chili Peppers, GNR, I mean, Estranged, sure, they played that video like crazy, but they didn't look so cool in that, and it was just, the video didn't make sense, it was pretty goofy, you know, they were just so big that I don't think that the average rocker could relate to them anymore. And like you said, the general rock audience had moved on, and even I had moved on, not from Guns N' Roses. I always loved Guns N' Roses, but I took the grunge route. You know, I grew a beard, and instead of having a, you know, fluffy hair, I had long straight hair, and
I just continued wearing flannels, but it was okay.
Right, exactly.
It was seamless.
But what people don't remember was that between 93 and I'd say 99, you couldn't find a single person with a Guns N' Roses shirt. They were dead. They were out of the picture. Nobody cared anymore. Now, the fans, you know, where's Axl? What the heck? You know, the guy was this egomaniac that, you know, was in the public eye for so long. Now, nobody's seen him for years. And I had some very specific theories about that, and I'd love to get into that in a future episode, you know, about why he disappeared, and it became sort of a thing with the fans, you know, and then when the internet came along, it really changed everything, and maybe for the better, but maybe not, and that's something we can get into in a future episode as well, because back in the day, I don't know about you, but I used to go Guns N' Roses shopping, you know, I would go to, you know, whatever record store in faraway city and hope to find like some special Guns N' Roses thing.
That was, yeah, that was every day for me.
Right.
I spent every last dime I got. I actually, when I was working at Ralph's, we had to join the retail clerks union, which as a 17-year-old, like, why? And it cost, I think it was like $400 to join the union, which when you're 17 and bagging groceries, like, that's a huge amount of money. So I had to go on the payment plan to join the union. And so I had one payment left. And I went into this record store called Hot Rocks Records, which I have lots of stories about Hot Rocks. But they had this box. So it was like this cardboard box with the Guns N' Roses logo and a chain. And inside was like some 12-inch import, a t-shirt, and a bumper sticker. And I had to have it. And so I spent the money I was saving for my union, because this thing was like $50, and got behind on my union due payments and almost lost my job.
Oh my God.
Because I had to have this box.
Wow. So
yeah, I was always Guns N' Roses shopping.
Well, I actually lost my job at Tower Records because of Guns N' Roses. And again, I want to save some of this for later episodes, because there's so much ground we haven't covered. Yeah, Hot Rocks. I used to belong to their frequent shopper whatever
plan. Did they have that?
Yeah, it was like $10, and you get 10% off on purchases for a year. And that worked out for me. So I got signed GNR stuff. You know, I got some box sets.
Were they nice to you? They were always such... And for those of you who have seen, I think, Wayne's World... In like one of the early scenes of Wayne's World, when they pick up their drunk friend off a park bench, he's actually in front of Hot Rocks Records in Covina.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because Hot Rocks started off on Grand, then it went to Covina. It's now called Chaos Records.
Is it still there?
Well, it's, I don't know if you remember the two owners. One was the older guy with the black hair that may have been not so nice to you. Yeah. He was always nice to me. He knew that I came in for Guns N' Roses.
They knew I came in for Guns N' Roses.
Really? They were mean?
Let me tell you, I used to go... because they used to get shipments. I don't know where the hell they got their shipments of like bootlegs or imports, but they used to get shipments in on Fridays. And so I would not eat lunch. Like I would have like a Dr. Pepper and a grandma's cookie for lunch. And so I would save my lunch money. And on Fridays, me and my friend Nova, who's the Cure and the Smiths fan, we would walk from Glendora High to Hot Rocks Records, which was like miles away.
Wow.
We would walk there. And if they had anything of Guns N' Roses, and that's where I got like most of my bootleg albums, I got there. And no, they were never nice.
Well, do you remember the blonde guy, Ray?
Yeah.
He was like, the more like the new wave guy.
Yeah.
Well, he still owns it. It's called Chaos Records.
Okay.
And it's on Citrus. And he's a super nice guy. But back then, it was Guns N' Roses and Morrissey. That's what they told me, that were the big things that they sold.
That was because me and my friend were going every Friday.
And I was going too. And I was buying high-end stuff. And I'll tell you what, for a guy that's making, $550 at Tower Records, like I bought this 3-CD thing live in Japan, which they ended up officially releasing. It's not even like a soundboard recording.
I think I bought that.
150 bones.
Did I buy that? I might have. I got my copy of Live Like a Suicide from them.
Wow.
And they were, so I would go every week, and every week I would buy whatever they had, and every week I'd say, do you have a copy of Live Like a Suicide? Like every week. And so it's Christmas of 89. It's like Christmas break, and I have Christmas money, and I'm saving it to spend on Motley Crue concert tickets. And my friend Nova calls me, and she goes, dude, like I was in Hot Rocks, they have Live Like a Suicide. I said, bullshit. Like they know I want it. They have my information. She goes, no, they have. So she walks in and she sees it and she goes, let me, this is before cell phones. And she goes, can I use your phone? I've got to call my friend. And they're like, well, you can go across the street to In-N-Out.
Oh, geez.
So she goes into the payphone and calls
me. No, wait a minute. I shouldn't even bring this up, but where are they located at this point where In-N-Out's across the street?
They're on Grand.
Oh, way back then.
They're like on, this is 80.
Gotcha,
89.
Gotcha.
They're like, yeah, they're like in this weird strip mall.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And so I call up, and there's this woman that worked there who was just awful. And I call and I said, yeah, do you have Live Like a Suicide? No. And I'm like, really? Like, my friend was just in there 3 minutes ago. Like, and she told me you have it. Well, I guess your friend told you wrong. And I'm like, oh, okay. And so she doesn't ask to see if they had it before I'm off the phone. She hangs up the phone and then asks, because I guess she was gone for Christmas, and realizes that they did have it. So my friend walks back in after having made the payphone call, and she goes, did you just call your friend and tell her we had this? Yeah. Oh, well, you need to go call her back, because I told her you didn't. And they make her go back to In-N-Out.
Oh my God.
And so she's like, so she calls me up, and I'm like, they don't have it. She goes, no, they do. I'm like, no, they do. So I call up. Do you have Live Like a Suicide? Yeah. Can you hold it for me? We can hold it for an hour.
Oh, my God.
And so I have to, like, beg my mom for a ride. And, like, my stepdad's grousing. And I'm like, I will do dishes till the end of time. And so my mom drives me there. I finally, somehow. So I sold a piece of my soul to somehow get a ride. And I walk in the back door, and the blonde guy turns to the girl and says, "I told you it would be her." Like, they knew. They knew me. They were so mean.
Why? I mean,
I don't know.
You know, it's funny.
I spent so much money there.
So the blonde guy, was he like a new wave blonde guy?
Yeah, because he had kind of long, feathery hair.
Right, because there was a period in the early 90s where
I have to say, like, he was generally... No, he was the nicest of the crew. He was. But the other... So once the Illusions came out and they were in Old Town Covina and they had the Illusion promotional posters...
Right.
And by this time, I've been going to them for years. Because I actually bought Motley Crue's Too Fast for Love on Leather Records from them for like $100.
Wow.
So I'd been shopping there for years. And so they had those promotional posters on the ceiling. And every time I walked in... I'm like, $100. I'll give you $100 for those posters. No, we like them. Like, they wouldn't even sell me those promotional posters.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because after my falling out with Adler, I started selling some of the peripheral items of my collection, which included posters and shirts. And for those Illusions promo posters, the big long ones,
yeah,
they had thumbtack holes in them. I think I got like $150.
Did you? Because I finally ended up buying them on eBay, but I bought them on eBay during that period where nobody gave a shit about Guns N' Roses.
Right.
So I think I got those for like $20 a piece.
Nice.
And yeah. I have them somewhere.
That period's gone. Yeah, because I sold an original Appetite shirt. And it was like a large, but it was never worn because it didn't fit me, but I bought it because I found it like in 92 or something. Mm-hmm. And $100 right there. And an original Lie shirt. The white Lie shirt, again, 100 bones.
Really?
But, yeah.
I always contemplate if I should sell the shirts or not.
No, don't sell them.
Or do a book.
Right. You know, my situation was unique, but also...
But what am I going to do with them?
Trust me, that's something that in 20 years you might want to consider selling, you know, because I don't think the value in those are going to decrease, you know, unless Axl or somebody does like a Michael Jackson, like gets really weird or something and... You know,
that's possible.
No, I don't want to say that. That's awful.
Maybe not that bad.
Although I was sad when Michael Jackson died, and I thought it was interesting that...
you mean died? I thought you just meant get really weird.
No, I did mean get really weird. And, you know, certain allegations, you know, if anything like that ever happened to a member of GNR, that could affect the collectability. For instance...
Oh, yeah, I would hope not.
You know, Stephen Collins of Seventh Heaven, you know, they recently came out with allegations against him. I don't think anybody's buying Commander William Decker action figures, Star Trek figures of him now. You know what I mean? Like, certain things can affect... you know, the perception of value for collector's items.
Yeah, I don't feel like Guns N' Roses that would have. I mean, I think they've just cemented their...
You think so?
At this point, you're right.
I think
they've cemented it.
Yeah.
I like to think they have.
Well, we got way off track, but we were talking about the Appetite tour. There are a few dates with Iron Maiden. It was supposed to be a whole tour, but then Axl's voice blew out.
So by the time Iron Maiden came to L.A., Guns N' Roses was not on.
That's right. And my brother went to that show, and it was L.A. Guns that filled in at the last minute.
Yes.
And at this point, people wanted to see Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
In L.A. here. And I think Slash and Steven joined L.A. Guns or Maiden on stage.
They did.
Yeah.
It might have been Duff, too. But yeah, definitely Slash.
And it's funny because I remember Izzy, I think he made a sarcastic comment about, you know, the upcoming Maiden tour before they embarked on it. He said something like, yeah, they really know how to lay down a groove. And when I read that, it struck me as sarcastic because obviously Maiden's not a grooving band. They're just a straight ahead, you know. So I don't think any of the guys were really excited about, you know, going on tour with Iron Maiden, but they were very excited to go on tour with Aerosmith. And obviously, Motley Crue was just a tour of decadence, especially from the stories that Steven told me, and I'd be happy to share them in future episodes.
Yeah, and they didn't make it. Motley Crue and Guns N' Roses didn't make it to L.A., which was, because I was a huge Motley Crue fan. They were my first love, and then Guns N' Roses, you know, took over. So they didn't make it to L.A., which was very bitter pill to swallow.
Were you watching to see if they were coming to L.A.?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that was, I think that was late 87, though.
Right. Yeah. That would have been like November 87.
November, December of 87.
Well, when was the first time you saw Guns N' Roses?
First time it was when they opened for Aerosmith. So oh, okay. I think it was September, if I remember correctly, I think it was September 21st, 1988.
Okay.
And I had to beg my brother to go. And I told my brother, my brother said, I really don't want to see Aerosmith. And I just saw Guns N' Roses. And the reason why, I don't know if you want to get into this tonight, the reason why my brother had just seen Guns N' Roses is because I won a contest for him to go to England.
Yes, this is one of the stories that made me contact you about doing a podcast because I think it's so amazing. Please tell it.
Yeah, so there used to be a lot of contests. So there'd be like MTV would do contests with the bands and there'd be radio contests. And I was forever entering these contests, but I was too young to actually qualify. So I was always entering my older brother because he was 18. He was old enough. So there was like go to Jamaica with Bon Jovi. And I think I entered that 100 times.
And by the way, I just want to mention to people, this is going to blow your mind. This is the type of thing that people talk about, like, hey, remember when MTV used to have those, contests, who won, or, Axel's Apartment, who won? You never know. This is that caliber. So I'm sorry to interrupt you,
That's
but this
okay.
is pretty impressive.
Yeah, so I would enter, there was like a go on a yacht or something with Molly. So I would always enter these contests, and I always, I'm 13, 14, and I'm always like believing in my heart of hearts, like, why not? Like, why can't I win? And so in the summer of 88, there was this syndicated radio show called Metal Shop, and it was on KNEC on Sunday, and so they did a contest to go to Castle Donington, the Monsters of Rock Festival. And so that year, it's 1988, Guns N' Roses is playing that year. And so I think Megadeth was playing, I think Kiss might have been playing, Maiden was playing, no, Metallica was playing.
No, it wasn't Metallica.
Oh, no, they were, okay, it was Megadeth, though.
Iron Maiden was headlining.
Okay.
And I think Kiss was playing.
Kiss was playing.
Halloween. Opened for Guns N' Roses.
Yes.
And I don't mean to sidetrack, but they were promoting their album, Keeper of the Seven Keys Part 2, which is a heavy metal classic. It's one of the best. But go ahead.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Metallica will come into play later on in the story, though. And so with this contest, you had to send in a postcard, and you had to say why you deserve to win. And so I thought, I only need to enter this once because, they're going to look at these reasons why. And so, a couple of months prior, I'd been at Disneyland on like an eighth grade honor society field trip. And it was with my friend Nova, my Cure Morrissey friend. And she had bought a bunch of postcards. And for some reason, one of the postcards she had bought, it was Mickey and Minnie on Main Street in the Tin Lizzie. For some reason, I just thought it was a great postcard. I said, can I have that? And she gave it to me. That was the postcard I sent into Metal Shop. And I said something just incredibly stupid, like, I deserve to go to Monsters of Rock because I'm going to teach those Brits how to party L.A. American style or something so stupid. And my brother, I'm filling this out. My brother walks by and goes, what are you doing? I'm like, well, I'm entering you in this contest. And he looks at it and goes, you are not sending that shit in with my name on it. And I'm like, but if we win, you get to go to Castle Donington. And he goes, oh, okay, I guess that's okay. And so I didn't really think I was going to win the trip to Donington, but there was like, they had 25 third place winners was a Seventh Son of a Seventh Son cassette tape. Anyway, Iron Maiden. And I thought, I'm going to win that. Like, come on, there's 25 of those. Like, I'm going to win a cassette tape.
Seven deadly sins, seven ways to win.
And so, I sent it in, and a few weeks later, my brother and I are both at my dad's house, and my mom calls, and my brother answers, and my mom says, did your sister enter you in a contest to go to England? And he goes, yeah. Well, you won. And we both just started screaming and jumping up and down, and then it slowly dawned on me that I wasn't going to actually...
Was it just one person?
No, it was two people.
Uh-huh.
So it was two people. So you had to be 18 to enter it, which is why I entered him. I was 14 at the time. And the radio, like the show was really unorganized because they contacted him, I think it was less than a week before he had to leave. And he was 18 and have a passport.
Wow.
And so, my mom explained the situation. Oh, it was my 14-year-old daughter that entered him. And, I think technically I could have gone. Like the state, the show wasn't thrilled because they'd have to be like release forms and blah blah blah. But my stepdad was not going to let me go to England at age 14
right.
to the Monsters of Rock festival. So my dad thought he should be able to go, but my brother was not going to take my father. father. And so he took his best friend.
Wow.
And so, and they had to go, you know, they had to go to the federal building and get rushes on the passports. And I remember going with him and standing in line for 3 hours. And
jeez.
And, but yeah, he won the trip and he got to go. He went to Donington. That was the first time he saw Guns N' Roses.
That's awesome. It was actually his second time he saw Guns N' Roses.
Oh, that's right, because he saw them at the street scene. You're right.
And I just looked up the lineup, and it was Halloween, Guns N' Roses, Megadeth, David Lee Roth. And yes. That would have been Skyscraper Tour.
Yes.
Kiss and Iron Maiden.
And he got to go on stage with Maiden to sing the opening of Heaven Can Wait.
Oh, my God.
So he stood, him and his friend, like, were both, like, legitimate Maiden fans. They got to stand on stage and sing into the microphone with Steve Harris.
Wow. And Guns N' Roses fans know how historic this is. Obviously, you know, footage of it is used in the Paradise City video. The black and white footage is from Donington. And Steven Adler told me that, you know, he saw all these things flying in the air. And he didn't know what they were. They were bottles. But when one came up on the stage, he realized that there were bottles of piss, that the people in the audience were pissing in bottles and then throwing them. You know, but they were pissing just to relieve themselves. Because if you look at that footage, the place is so jam-packed. And obviously, what happened?
Two people died during Guns N' Roses' set
because right.
It was so crowded. Going back to bottles of piss, my brother said there were people that brought like giant, like the Sparklets water jugs with them for that purpose.
Right.
And then they would kind of half fill them and just start throwing them like all around the audience.
Isn't that crazy?
It was brutal. Like, I couldn't have hacked it.
No. Retrospect. For me, you know, I judge a venue by its bathroom facilities, you know.
Castle Donington.
I used to be the guy that would drink at shows. Not anymore, because now I have to pee all the time. Yeah. And, you know, I'm 46 years old. What do you want? You know, I don't feel 46, but I'm an old man.
But, yeah, but I told him, I said, you know, and as he was leaving, I said, dude, the only thing I want
is a program.
You know, it was an autograph from Slash.
Because
they were going to have backstage access, which right. They did. They had backstage access.
And the reason you thought Metallica was there, because there's a ton of photos.
They hung out with Lars.
Lars and Lemmy was there, too.
Yeah, but they have, like, I have somewhere, I have a picture of Lars. And they, you know, Lars autographed something for me. I don't even know if I had it. And whatever he signed, my brother's friend looked at him and said, Lars, you're really fucked up. And so underneath his autograph, he wrote fucked up, which I have somewhere.
That's awesome.
But while they were hanging out backstage, Slash actually came backstage. And, you know, Guns N' Roses was pretty big by that. They were big by that time, but I still don't know if people were instantly recognizing them.
Well, Sweet Child was out, wasn't it?
It was out. But I think when Slash came backstage, he had his hair out of his face. So I don't think people recognized him. And my brother saw him and recognized him, and he said something like, hey, Slash, like really loud, and drew all this attention to Slash. And so he walked up to him and says, dude, you know, can I get an autograph? I need to get an autograph for my sister. It's like the one thing she wants. And he said, yeah, hold on. And he just kind of walked away and never came back.
Aww.
But when my brother calls, because my brother and I have a weird relationship, he calls me and says, yeah, I met Slash and he was such a dick.
But he was. He walked away.
He did walk away. But I was like so, I was so devastated.
Man, Slash is
Slash has been devastating me.
Well, we're going to redeem him in future episodes.
Oh, we are.
Yeah.
And I had a cat named Slash for many years. That was a beloved cat.
And even the cat walked away from you from time to time and ignored you, didn't it?
The cat did. The cat used to actually claw my Guns N' Roses pictures on the wall.
Oh, man.
Yeah, the cat didn't appreciate Guns N' Roses.
Well, in the Paradise City video, there is footage of backstage, like Alan Niven with Slash. And I think Alan Niven takes his hat, you know, and there's the scene where Slash, one guy that got an autograph is the guy that Slash signs his jacket.
Yeah. So he did sign somebody's autograph. So yeah, my brother got to go, and so he, you know, he comes back. So he has this amazing trip, and to his credit, like he brought me, you know, tons of stuff, and he went shopping and he found like photos of Marilyn Monroe he brought back for me, and so I think he did appreciate it to an extent. But then when Guns N' Roses comes opening for Aerosmith, he tells me, oh, why would I want to go see, like, I don't like Aerosmith, and why would I go see Guns N' Roses? I just saw them. And so my dad ended up going to a scalper and buying tickets, and my brother ended up going to the concert with me anyway.
Did he really?
Yes, he did.
Well, you know, that's funny. But back to Donington, the first time I heard that show, I got a vinyl bootleg.
Yeah.
And it was like an audience recording. And it's a pretty messed up show. Like, dude, they literally have to stop the song, you know, a few times, and Axl's like, hey, you know, we got people that are getting pretty smashed up here, you know, back up. So really, a lot of that show is they're distracted by what's going on, like, yeah, literally. And then obviously they pulled two people out, and Duff even said, he said, they didn't look like there was any life in those bodies.
Yeah.
And then some video footage surfaced, but it was really crappy. But you could see where they're, like, they're walking to the edge of the stage, the band, and pointing. Like, Steven Adler, like, walks up to the edge of the stage and points. He's like, man, that's some fucked up shit down there. What's interesting about the quality of that footage is that I got, like, first-generation quality of Halloween's performance from the same camera, same angle. You know, I got first-generation A-plus quality of Halloween from Donington from the same camera, but for some reason with the Guns N' Roses footage, like, it's all generated. And I mean, maybe on YouTube now there's cleaner footage.
Yeah,
but I've
never actually seen that footage. I don't know if I'd actually want to.
Yeah, it's from, like, it's like from the left side of the audience facing the stage. And very interesting show. And Guns N' Roses was, you could almost say they were wildly popular in England at that time. And obviously that's what caused this rush to the stage. You know, bands like, you know, like David Lee Roth, Skyscraper didn't have any hits on it that I know of. And Iron Maiden, you know, as much as I love Iron Maiden, and that was a huge production, The Seventh Son of a Seventh Son. But for me, it kind of ended with Power Slave, mm-hmm, you know, a Number of the Beast being their Appetite for Destruction. But anyway, I digress. So you did eventually go see them opening for Aerosmith.
I did see them opening for Aerosmith. But just going back one more thing to the contest, you know, to add insult to injury, that first prize was also supposed to include a free pair of Levi's 501 jeans, and I never got the jeans.
But that's not insult to injury, really.
My brother got to go to England. I couldn't even get my lousy pair of jeans. Thank you, Metal Shop.
But you know what's funny? I have a 2-record set that I never got to listen to, but it's Metal Shop, you know, the radio show featuring Axl Rose, and I must have got it like in 2000, and I haven't had a turntable ever to listen to it. I wonder if, you know, in this album, like, if they mentioned the Donington contest, that would be pretty neat.
That would be, wouldn't it?
But here's the thing. You have bragging rights. You actually won a contest to go see Guns N' Roses at Donington, so that's pretty amazing. Now, do you have any memories of the Aerosmith show?
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, that was, you know, by this time I am, you know, I've been a Guns N' Roses fan for a year at this point. This is September of 88, and so I am, you know, 14 years old. Like, going to see your favorite band live, like, it's, there's nothing like it. Like, it's unparalleled. And so we go there, you know, and the concert, and by that time I started, like, I'd seen Motley Crue. Had I seen Metallica yet? No, I'd been to a Motley Crue concert. I might have been to a couple of others by that time. I was finally of the concert-going age. And anytime you'd go to see a band, like, there would always be some sort of grand entrance. Like, the lights would be out and the, you know, the band would show up or the curtain would drop. And Guns N' Roses, the guy announces them, and they just stroll on stage. They just kind of stroll on stage. Izzy picks up his guitar and starts to kind of fiddle around. And, you know, and they're just so unpretentious. And then they all get into place. They all look around and start playing, like, the toned-down version of You're Crazy.
Oh, nice.
And that's how they open the show.
Nice.
And it's amazing.
Well, you know, I think it could be said for, I think, bands of that era, especially the 70s, there was no big production necessarily. Like, even Kiss, before they came on, you would hear, like, guitars being tuned and stuff.
Yeah.
Stuff that they would never do now because they're, like, the consummate pros.
Right.
But
back, that was unexpected.
It was,
like,
still,
for me, like, in 1988, right, like, that was, because when Aerosmith comes on, they made a grand entrance. But yeah, they were just amazing, and they've all patience. It was just the craziest crowd. Like, the crowd was just going wild, and it was at the Pacific Amphitheater, and
we
had really good seats. We were, like, in the second row, like the third row back, and it was just amazing. But there, you know, there's, like, people fighting around us, and there's a guy, like, at one point I look next to me, and the guy standing next to me is just taking a piss while standing up, right in the aisle, and somebody else is throwing up next to us. But it was so high energy, and that the place was full. Like, the place usually isn't full for the opening act, and for Guns N' Roses, that venue was full.
Nice.
And it was just absolutely amazing. And this was, you know, a couple months before Lies came out, so they're playing, like, Patience, and they're playing Used to Love Her, and, you know, it was just, they did not play Rocket Queen, I remember that. But it was just amazing. And then, you know, Aerosmith comes. And Aerosmith was great. Aerosmith was fantastic. They weren't the energy in the crowd, like, was good. Not as high as Guns N' Roses.
Wow.
And then the band comes out. Guns N' Roses comes out at the end, and they play Mamakin.
Well, here's the thing. They were on fire back then. I mean, there was a dynamic there on stage that even Aerosmith couldn't match.
Yeah.
No, Aerosmith, maybe just a little past their prime at that point, if you want to argue that the 70s were their heyday.
Yeah.
But, you know, they definitely got more commercial, more radio-friendly, you know, by the time that they're on tour with Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, this is Permanent Record, so this is kind of like their big comeback album.
Right.
Which is a decent
album. Permanent Vacation.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, Permanent Vacation. So they were playing a lot of their 70s hits on this tour.
Right.
So they were great. They were great, but man,
Guns N' Roses was... They're hungry.
Holy shit, they were amazing.
Yeah. I mean, and that's one of the things that you can't appreciate unless you were there, you know? And watching those old videos, it's just like, oh, my God. Like, do you remember when the first acoustic version of You're Crazy was released?
Oh, yeah.
It was a B-side.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the version that was on live.
Right.
But I remember thinking, like, this band is so versatile.
That,
like,
they could turn that song from Appetite into...
Right. And yeah. Did you ever see the Felt Forum show? It's a widely circulated...
I've never seen it, no. I've heard it.
Felt Forum in New York.
Yeah. I think I have a bootleg of it somewhere.
It's like a solid two-hour show. Yeah. And they do the version of You're Crazy where the first half is slow and then Axl's like, suck on this! And it goes right into the fast version. I've never seen a band on fire like that.
No.
Slash is on fire. You know, and Slash is an unbelievable player. And I think toward the end of the Illusions tour, you know, he's getting a little sloppier. I mean, again, this is just my perception. I don't know if I'm completely accurate or not. But when you watch him, like on this Felt Forum show and on the Appetite tour, the guy is just smoking, like scary smoking.
Well, and with these Aerosmith shows, I mean, this is because they didn't come on, you know, they didn't come with Motley Crue, they didn't come with Iron Maiden, so this is the first time they're playing Los Angeles since they've broken huge.
Right.
So this is like their big homecoming.
Gotcha.
So they were, no, it is the, like, I saw Guns N' Roses 9 times. This was possibly the best show. There's one other show that's amazing that I'm sure we'll talk about at some point. But this first time I saw them, yeah. Like, it was one of the best performances I've ever seen.
Wow.
Of any band.
Well, that's saying a lot, because you've seen a lot of bands.
I've seen a lot of bands.
And that's one thing that we didn't really mention, that we have a pretty wide scope of likes as far as music and appreciation, you know.
Oh, yeah. Like, I've seen, yeah. I mean, as obsessed as I was with Guns N' Roses, and I was, I mean, I still liked other bands and still went to, going to concerts was, that was it. Like, that was just the high point of my teenage life. And I feel sorry for kids nowadays, you know, because the, you know, I remember when Guns N' Roses played with the Rolling Stones, the tickets were $36. That included the service fees, and we were pissed that they were that expensive.
I remember the most I ever paid for a ticket, you know, in the old days, Guns N' Roses and Metallica, $27.50.
And it was an outrage.
Right.
Like, it was an outrage.
Well, it wasn't an outrage for Guns N' Roses and Metallica.
$36 for the Rolling Stones and Guns N' Roses was an outrage.
Right.
So I don't know how kids go to concerts
now. Did you go to that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we don't want to blow everything here, but look, this girl actually saw them open for the Stones, too.
Yeah.
How amazing is that? And I remember, you know, because I was living in New Jersey at that time, that the word came out that Guns N' Roses, because again, this is after a hiatus. They hadn't done anything for like a year when
a year. And again, like a year at that time, that was a long year.
And it was when, like, I don't know if
really
it's
really long year.
I don't know if the universe changed or it's just because we're younger and these things, you know.
Yeah.
But when I heard that, you know, Guns N' Roses was opening for the Stones and the Stones were doing a pay per view, I remember like, oh, I got it. Get a videotape because Guns N' Roses is going to open that show. Like, I for some reason I had it in my mind that the pay-per-view coming up was going to include a Guns N' Roses show, and was disappointed to learn that, you know, it was just Axl and Izzy coming.
Oh, they did Salt of the Earth.
Yeah, which is pretty darn cool.
Great. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, Izzy, I don't know if you can even hear him in the mix, you know, but it's sort of neat to see Axl and Izzy, you know, and not Axl and Slash, you know.
Yeah. But I won't go into, we'll save it for a later date, but I will say, so the course of my life, there are those monumental days. There's, you know, the birth of my daughter, my wedding, the day I met my husband, the day of my Anne Dvorak book release party, Guns N' Roses, Rolling Stones. I would place that as quite possibly the fifth best day of my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you remember which night you went?
I went the last night.
Okay.
So it was the Sunday, I think it was October 22nd, the night it rained.
Did you get in time for Living Color?
We got there in time for Living Color. I didn't go in.
Oh, because I remember, I think it may have been the last night where Vernon Reid, the guitar player of Living Color, addressed, you know, Axl and One in a Million. And
he might have. I didn't actually go in to hear them. But yeah, that whole 4 days is a whole other topic of conversation.
Well, you know what was interesting was that there was a moment during those shows, because, you know, we're getting the news about those shows, the Guns N' Roses fans. And there was a moment, I think it was the earliest moment that Guns N' Roses may have jumped the shark, where people were like, oh, okay, I'm having a bit much of this. Where Axl said, this is going to be the last Guns N' Roses show. You know,
unless certain people stop dancing with Mr. Brownstone.
You know, and that became news. But I remember in my circle of, you know, friends, and I had cool friends, rocker friends, you know. And at that point, it was like, you know, enough of the drama, you know.
Oh, see, over here, like, it was big news. And it was, there was speculation running rampant. And maybe for
your age group.
Oh, yeah.
I think my age group is like, nobody's going to walk away from this gold mine called Guns N' Roses.
Oh, for us 15-year-olds, right. Especially those of us who had tickets for subsequent nights of the show. Yeah, it was a big deal.
And one other thing I wanted to mention, since I mentioned jumping the shark, the one point on Appetite, and now I'm totally digressing, I don't know if you felt the same way, but the one part that I thought was not genuine and kind of turned me off, I thought was cheesy, was Out to Get Me, I'm fucking innocent. I thought that was a gratuitous use of fuck, because at that point, it's like, they use it, you know, so tastefully that I was like, oh man, this is badass. And that just seemed thrown out for the sake of it.
Yeah, I'm 13, so every fuck was gold for me.
I don't know how to take that exactly.
It was, yeah. Yeah, nothing. Yeah, it was all just...
Hell, I didn't even have a fuck when I was 13 yet. That's pretty good. Oh, you mean the word, not the act.
No. Gotcha. The act. But yeah, for a band to be cussing that much, I'd never heard it. So yeah, it was, every fuck was incredibly cool.
You know, it's interesting, because that's another thing. Like, how did they know? Because nobody was cursing in songs back then.
No,
not at all. I mean, except for punk rock. Nobody was cursing in songs. I can't think off the top of my head of one popular metal band that had a curse word in a song. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they wanted to do the punk rock attitude. But who knew? Like, for me, I didn't know anything about punk rock in the 80s. You know, all I knew was, like, kill your mother. I didn't really know about the underlying political statements or whatever, you know. And so I just associated punk rock with cursing and low-level musicianship. So when these guys come out, why don't you just fuck off? You know, it was genuine, and you felt it, and it was cool.
It was amazing. Like, it really, as hokey as it might sound now, like, it was amazing to hear a band do that.
Right. And what people don't realize, I don't think, is that, well, obviously, Guns N' Roses changed the entire musical landscape, especially as far as image is concerned. You know, all of a sudden, people are toning down their image. You know, Motley Crue, Girls, 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 is a far departure from Theater of Pain, you know. And everybody's getting a little more, even Stryper. They released an album called Against the Law, and it's a non-Christian album. Now they got facial hair, you know. Guns N' Roses was responsible for that. Not only that, Guns N' Roses was responsible for the tattoo explosion. And I know that sounds crazy, but back in the day, I remember Adam Curry, like, interviewing Steven and Slash. Oh, you guys have tattoos. Tell me about your tattoos. Bands really didn't have tattoos. Maybe Bon Scott from AC/DC, who seemed like an old man to us, you know, at the time. Like, he seemed like an old sailor who would have a tattoo. Guns N' Roses having tattoos was like a big deal, and people talked about it.
Well, I think they had, because Motley Crue had tattoos, but Axl had just the vibrant, just right. You know, like, on his forearms, which you just didn't see. Just they were so just in your face, and you know, that's not even something he bothered to try to hide. So yeah, you just didn't see that,
right? And 7 years later, everybody and their mother has tattoos. Yeah. You know, maybe I'm going a little crazy attributing it to Guns N' Roses, but you know, I think it possibly could be where it started. They made it hip. And not only that, but they bridged the gap from, you know, this overproduced commercial rock to come out, you know, down and dirty, real, authentic, hard rock. And that paves the way for Nirvana. You know, where do you go from there? You know, and you have to get more real, you know. And if it wasn't for Guns N' Roses, I don't know if, like, the grunge scene would have happened the way it did, you know, because people now are looking for authentic music that's not overproduced, that's not overly polished, and that's angry, stuff that they can relate to.
Yeah, and is that around anymore? I don't know. I'm so out of touch.
No, you know, you were talking about how you feel bad for kids today. I work with young people a lot, and I say, hey, I, in fact, I gave up asking what's your favorite band. There's no such thing as a favorite band anymore. Yeah. It's all about songs. Oh, I got this song from Guns N' Roses. I got Welcome to the Jungle. You know? But even with the big acts of today, nobody's really in, like, they go to the shows. That's just sort of a thing you do. But nobody's, like, hardcore about any specific band. It's all about songs. You know, it's MP3s. I got 50,000 songs on my iPod or whatever, you know. And it's definitely a different scene. It's a whole different landscape. And I don't know if it's a bad thing for young people. I mean, it's just the way it's evolved. I know when I try to put on some of my, you know, music at work or something, and some of the young people, like, roll their eyes. You know, I'm like the old dinosaur, you know, and then on the other hand, I have to listen to, you know, their radio stations and hear Taylor Swift 10 times a day, literally, and this new song, Uptown Funk, literally on Monday, I counted it 7 times in an 8-hour shift. So today, I got it in early and I put on my iPod, and, you know, it has Guns N' Roses and AC/DC and stuff like that. And at one point, I looked back at, you know, some of my coworkers, like, are you guys jonesing for Taylor Swift or Uptown Funk yet? You know, and they were cool about it, but it's just interesting, the dynamic. And Gene Simmons recently said that rock is dead, and he could be right. You know, we should probably stop here. We have so much to talk about, but we're running just over an hour, and I don't want to bore people. So we'll produce a new episode quickly, you know, in case there's any interest. But you know, it's been great seeing you, and I'm glad that we got to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. 20 years later, who would have thought?
Exactly. I mean, when I saw that girl, you were like a Catholic schoolgirl back then, all prim and innocent, but you had that love of Slash, and we bonded.
And I did have really big hair, though.
And I always wore the bandana, too. But all right, people, good night.
See ya.
Original music produced by Brooke Ellis. All Jungle Natives content, all rights reserved.